Welcome back to the Early Morning Late Show. Bill Arnold here. My next guest is someone that I have admired his work for a couple of years now, and getting him on the show, for me, big thrill. And his name is Kent Dunnington. He's an associate professor of philosophy at Biola University. He holds a PhD in philosophy from Texas A&M and an MTS in theology from Duke University. He's written a book called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. And if you know from my weekend program, my co-host with George Fraser called Real Recovery, this is a subject near and dear to my heart. Kent, good morning.
Good morning.
And now, just so you know, I'm a big, big fan. And so I'm just so thrilled to be able to have you on the show. I'd say let's get to it. Let's open this big bag of snakes. Because what I want to do is learn from your perspective this book you've written called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. What is the nature of addiction?
That is a big question, and it's a question that really got me interested in writing this book. There are two predominant models that people use to think about addiction. One is by far the dominant model in contemporary discussions, and it's what in the book I call the disease model. Some people talk about it as the medical model, and the idea there is that addiction is a disease. It's something that happens to us, and therefore it's not something for which people should be blamed. It's something that we should respond to in the same way that we respond to other diseases. So we should feel pity and we should seek medical assistance for ourselves if we have addictions or others if they have addictions. So if you put that at one end of the spectrum, addiction is something that happens to us. It's not something that we do. On the extreme other end of the spectrum is what in the book I call the choice model of addiction. Sometimes it's called the moral model of addiction. And the idea there is that addiction is nothing more than a series of bad, immoral choices. And so people are in control of their actions throughout the addictive process, and they just repeatedly choose to do things that they know are harmful to themselves or other people. So on one extreme, what philosophers call our agency, our ability to control what we do, is completely taken away on the medical model. On the other extreme, we view addicts as people with full agency and therefore as people that are especially morally corrupt. And to me, both of those models fail. If you yourself have been addicted, or if you know people who are addicted, you know that both of those ways of thinking about what's going on in addiction are overly simplified. And so in the book, I try to chart sort of a middle way between those two. And I talk about addiction as a complex habit. And the idea there is that habits actually do, in some sense, remove our agency. When a habit has a profound grip on our lives, we lose a lot of immediate voluntary control over what we do in the domain of that habit. But also that habit is, it's a part of our character. And so a habit is not something that happens to us. In most cases, it's something that we develop. So I try in the book to suggest that if we think about addiction as an incredibly powerful and complex habit, we're in a better position to address it in our lives and in the lives of people that we know and love.
Now, Kent, it seems that we have learned how to medicalize sin, where we're not really thieves anymore, we're kleptomaniacs, and we're not immorally dealing with sexual issues, we're sex addicts. So we're finding language today that's replacing sin. We're getting rid of some of this language and replacing it with terms that are much more sanitized.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's exactly right. One interesting question from the perspective of Christian thought is, why is that? You know, what's going on? Part of what I try to do in the book is there's a certain approach to the addiction and recovery field that is highly critical and highly suspect, and even sometimes things in terms of a conspiracy, you know, sort of secular conspiracy against Christianity or a medical conspiracy. My book does not take that perspective. However, I do think that there has been a loss of the resources that Christianity brings to bear on thinking about this aspect of our lives. Now, why is that? Part of what I suggest in the book is that in many respects, it's the fault of the church and of Christianity. I think that there is a strong reaction, for instance, in AA against the language of sin. But if you go back and look at why AA is so resistant to the language of sin, it's because so much of the language of sin in contemporary 19th and 20th century theology has been what theologically we would call Pelagian. That is to say, it's been overly insistent on a sort of vaunted human agency. And in fact, if you go back in the theological tradition, when you read someone like Augustine, for instance, talking about sin, sin is often thought of in terms of a powerful habit that has gotten a grip over our lives and requires more than something just like, you know, positive thinking or the exertion of willpower to overcome. So I think when we actually think carefully about sin, about its power over our lives, then it turns out that the category of sin is not only capable of making sense of much of addiction, but is in many respects necessary for making sense of certain aspects of addiction.
Now, Kent, so when we talk about even something like the paradox of addiction, when an addicted person, you know, claims that they are literally powerless over their addicted behavior, that admission is the starting point for regaining power over that same behavior. So explain that.
Yeah, so in the book I talk about what I call the paradox of addiction, which is that, on the, as you just put it, Bill, on the one hand, people claim a complete loss of agency or ability to act with respect to their addiction, but then, as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous states, that very admission is itself the first step in the process of recovery. And it's important to understand that most of the time, in most cases, this process of recovery is in a non-medicalized setting, so it doesn't involve pharmacological intervention or anything like that. So I suggest that the way to understand that is not to think that in fact people are utterly powerless over their addictions, but rather that they are utterly powerless to make a succession of choices to resist the addiction. So they have what you might call indirect control over their addiction, but they don't have direct control. So I think those who haven't been addicted, for instance, or don't understand the grip of extreme addiction, often think, why can't this person just for a period of time white-knuckle it? Mm-hmm. And every time they have the desire to use, say no. And what the big book is saying when it says we've admitted we're powerless is that strategy doesn't work. But when it says that by admitting our powerlessness, we discover this is the first step in the process of recovery, what that's suggesting is that there's an indirect control we have over our addictive behaviors. And that indirect control is available because of our ability to create a different set of habits that provides an alternative course of action. So just to give one simple example, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a huge emphasis placed on what they call people, places, and things. So if you're an addict, probably instead of thinking about white-knuckling it every time you want a drink or a hit, what you have to think about is creating an alternative life with new people, new places, and new things. And if you direct your agency toward the formation of habits of sobriety, you may have a chance of beating your addiction. So it has to do with what you should be focusing your agency on. And the admission of powerlessness is simply a sort of wisdom that says, we found that if we just focused our agency on resisting addictive choice, we almost always fail.
Mm. Wow. Kent, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, more with Kent Dunnington, and his book is called Addiction and Virtue: Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. Thanks for being with us. We'll be right back. All right, we are having a very lively discussion with Kent Dunnington. He is the Associate Professor of Philosophy at Biola University, which I believe is in Southern Cal, isn't it?
That's right, in La Mirada in Orange County.
Oh, you know, I went from being jealous to being really jealous. That's a nice place to live.
Yeah, it's a good place to be.
Okay, Kent, your book, Addiction and Virtue: Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice, raises this question. What does any of this, alcoholism, addiction, or recovery, have to do with virtue?
Part of the point of the book is to get us thinking about addiction as what I call a complex habit. Virtues are habits. So if you think about a virtue like kindness, for instance, or a courage, let's say courage is a virtue. When we say that someone has the virtue of courage, what we mean is not simply that in certain circumstances they act courageously, but that they have a disposition to do so. In other words, they don't have to generate and exert profound willpower in order to act courageously. It's something that has become part of their character. And in the book, I argue that all habits, particularly complex habits, habits that affect the way we think, affect the way our body acts. These are strategies, what I call in the book, strategies of desire. So we need lots and lots of habits to be able to get through our day smoothly. Otherwise, if we depended upon on willpower to make decisions moment after moment that contribute to our flourishing, we would be utterly exhausted. So what I suggest in the book is that the reason that addiction is so powerful, and in many ways this is the most important point I want to get across in the book. I want to get people out of the position of sort of moral critic mm-hmm. and into a position of sympathy with those who have major addictions. The reason that addiction is so powerful is because it does actually put us in a position to achieve many of the goods that people seek in life. Addiction has this powerful ability to order our lives, to make sense of our lives, to give us one pursuit that can help us make decisions about other aspects of our lives. The only problem is that it destroys us. Were it not for the incredible destructive power of addiction, objects of major addiction would in fact bring much order to our lives. And anything that can do that, anything that can make our lives better able to achieve what we think we need for flourishing, creates a habit. Virtues are, there's a long tradition of thinking about the virtues, which is thinking about those habits that if we work to create them, will in fact bring about genuine flourishing. And so part of what I really want to suggest in the book is that the only antidote to a life of addiction is the creation of a life of deep virtue. And much as the first step of AA suggests, I think the way to respond to addiction is not, again, by white-knuckling it, but by thinking about communities and practices that enable us to create virtues that resist addictive ways of life.
Mm-hmm. I am taking notes as quickly as I can. The 12-step programs, and of course, they do a great job of bringing people together in community, giving them a place to find sobriety, but it's also a place where there is a high rate of relapse. The success rate for people out of that program is not great, but it's also, as we are trying to see God through that program, they talk about God as we understand him. And that is going to be problematic for anybody who is looking for strength in a higher power, because only Jesus can deliver the higher power.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I talk about this some in the book. There's so much to learn from the 12-step tradition. And a big part of the book is trying to mine some of the wisdom from that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, I think the emphasis on what I call in the book apprenticeship relationships, so the idea of a sponsor is mm-hmm. a powerful idea that I think people in the church have a lot to learn from. The idea of confession as the centerpiece of a community of recovery is another idea that I think the church has a lot to learn from. Just mentioned in passing that one of the experiences that made me so interested in addiction recovery was attending a 12-step program with my mentor in mm-hmm. graduate school, who was a long-time recovering alcoholic. And I was astonished by the level of honesty and confession that was taking place in the room. And as someone who had grown up in the church, I remember thinking to myself, you know, this is the sort of thing that we're told is supposed to happen in the church, but rarely does. So there's so much to learn from the 12-step tradition. But like you say, Bill, there are theological problems in the development of that tradition. And one of them is the idea that we can be in control of sort of forming our own concept of whatever God will help us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from the Christian point of view, what that does is sort of rehearse yet again one of the problems that's at the root of addiction, which is an insistence on being in control of our own identity and our own destiny.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that people who are in the grips of major addiction lose control over their lives. That's true. But we ought not allow that to obscure the fact that one of the great attractions of addiction is that it provides us with a certain kind of control over our lives. And, I mean, AA and the 12-step tradition is sort of mixed about this, right? On the one hand, lots of it is about relinquishing control over our lives and undertaking an aggressive moral inventory, so on and so forth. But I think in an effort to have the biggest tent possible, AA makes a theological mistake of sort of giving us too much control over our understanding of the higher power. And that's something that I think Christians can be rightfully worried about and critical of.
Mm-hmm. Kent, just as we wrap things up here, what do you think churches can do to be more welcoming to hearing people's issues when it comes to addiction? Because everybody kind of shows up Sunday on their best behavior, and they really don't want to end up on 9 people's prayer lists under the form of gossip.
That's a great question, and the whole final chapter of my book is trying to grapple with that question. What kind of a church would be capable of resisting the powerful pull of addiction in all of our lives?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that I would like to say about that, particularly on this program, but I'll just say one thing. I think there's well-meaning Christians might have a perspective like this. Look, addiction is not a problem in my life, but I do want to be helpful to those who are addicted, and so I want my church to have programs that help such people. I appreciate that sentiment, and I know it comes from a good place, but I think that approach is not only probably not going to be helpful to people with major addictions, but it passes up an opportunity for a church to become a more authentic place of Jesus following.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we need to understand is that addicts in any society, addicts are what I call in my book unwitting prophets. They point us to all the ways in which our societies and our communities cut people off from lives of flourishing, from healthy lives.
Mm-hmm.
We need such people in our communities in the same way that coal miners needed canaries with them in the bottom of the coal mine, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I want to see happen more than anything is a shift in perspective where Christians in their church say, not only we want programs that help addicted persons in our congregation, but rather we want to be a kind of church where if a major addict walks in the front door to the Sunday morning service, they know soon upon arriving that this is a place where addiction is nothing to be ashamed of. And there are lots of ways of trying to achieve that. But I think to have that shift in perspective, not that addiction is a sort of serious problem that we should deal with in the shadows, but that to be a church where a major addict could walk in and begin to feel at home very quickly, that's a kind of shift in ethos in a church that I would want to encourage.
Mm. Kent, the world is a better place because you're in it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the book is called Addiction and Virtue: Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. Dr. Kent Dunnington is the author and guest on the show. Thank you so much for being on the show, and have a great rest
of
the day.
Good to be with you. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, we'll take a short break and be right back.